This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at WAEPA.org. Here's your host, Mike Causey.
Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and this is a historic day. I'm reminded by Eric White, our producer. This is the first live show we've done. Eric and I have been in studio, but it's the first time we've had a live guest, as it were, in about 15 months, and really happy to have Arthur Stein here. Art is well known to people who listen to the show regularly or who read the Federal Report column. He is a financial planner in the Washington area, very well known, has his own blog. Many of his clients are either federal workers, active federal workers, or retired federal employees. So he's up on the way the government thrift savings plan works and how government employees think and manage their money in general. And Art, you step on your toes here, but your background is absolutely fascinating. You worked for the House Ways and Means Committee as an economist?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's and a master's in economics, and I worked overseas in Africa for 2 years as an economist for the government of Botswana. I was a Peace Corps volunteer at the time, but I was an economist in their Ministry of Finance. And then I taught at a university in Australia, and I came back here. I was on the House Ways and Means Committee, a staff economist, and then I ran my own business for a while, and then I became a financial planner and a certified financial planner in about 1992.
So you've been there, done that, got the T-shirt and all that. Yeah. It's funny, the movie, fabulous movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, on television last week, and I thought of you because I actually know somebody who's been to Botswana.
And the Kalahari Desert.
It's such a wonderful movie. Everybody should see it. The theme of today's show and the column is people who are in the thrift savings plan, and I think everybody agrees everyone should be in the thrift savings plan.
Absolutely.
And everyone should max out at least enough to get the 5% government match if they're eligible for it. It's just an incredible perk that is not available in the private sector very, very widely. And one of the things to do is, and people have done extremely well. I think there's 75,000, as of last March, TSP millionaires, people with anywhere from $1 million to a little over $6 million in their accounts. The early TSP millionaires were all political appointees. They were members of Congress, or they were high-priced private sector attorneys who transferred in often as federal judges. But now the vast majority, a huge majority of TSP millionaires are self-made. These are people who invested. They invested by and large in the stock index funds, the SC and the I funds, and they wrote it out for, I think literally the average is 29 years, and some more, obviously some less. But what's been the experience with your clients?
With the TSP?
Yeah.
Well, the experience is all over the lot. I mean, I have clients who, when they came to meet me, you know, had all their money in the G fund and didn't have a lot of money. And I had clients who, when they first came to meet me, you know, had $1 million in the TSP because they had, you know, put most of their money and consistently put money in the stock funds, in the CS and I funds. So it varies, you know, tremendously. And it, you know, one of the things that we do as financial planners is, you know, we work with people's individual situation. And it's interesting. I mean, I spoke just this week to three people, prospects, you know, who one was 85, still working, has $2.5 million in his TSP account. He's 85 and he's still working.
Good man.
And sounded sharp as a tack.
Yeah.
He thinks he might be ready for retirement.
Uh-huh. He consider it, yeah.
And then on the other end of the scale, you know, I have someone who actually is doing retirement planning with us because he's 58 and he wants to retire like now.
Yeah.
And, of course, that raises an enormous number of issues for him in terms of how much money he'll have. And he doesn't have enormous amounts of investments in the TSP or anywhere else. So it's a much more difficult situation. You know, we doing a retirement plan for a 62-year-old who wants to retire, and he's basically a G fund investor, and his whole career, I'd say almost always, just G fund, and it's really cost him, and it really affects his ability to retire.
Does he realize it?
Yes, I think he realizes it, but he just.
Just can't do it.
He can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even just can't do it.
You know, I completely understand that. And I know during the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, people who said, I know this is the wrong thing to do, but I can't sleep at night. I have to get out of the market. And so they sold when the stocks had bottomed, got into the G fund, stayed in the G fund during that year period. When the market was recovering, they did not buy low, and many of them still haven't returned to it. But it's a fear, and it's totally understandable.
Yes, it is understandable, but it's like that's why you need professional advice, you know, because it's not a good move. And I speaking to one of my investment clients 2 weeks ago. She told me. She wanted to sell all her stock funds because of President Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when President Trump was elected, then I had a different set of clients who wanted to sell everything. Because of President Trump. And there's always a reason to panic and sell.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always bad stuff going on. But historically, you know, what we've seen is that the stock market has done extremely well over long periods of time, not short periods of time. And, you know, even over the last 12 months, the returns are incredible. The C fund's up 39% over the last 12 months, and the S fund's up 60%. And, you know, that's partly timing because we're coming out of that March decline. But even just this year, I mean, the C and the S fund are both up 13% this year, and the I fund's up 10%. And that's less than, you know, that's just short of a 6-month period. And so for people who aren't currently invested in those funds, I mean, those funds could not go up at all through the rest of the year, you know, like maybe there's zero increase from now on, and we'd still have a really good year. You know, it'd still be a really good year.
As recently as last week, people were talking about a recession. You know, the market was down, what, 3 or 4 days in a row? And some of the—
Everyone was panicked, and inflation was supposed to be shooting up, and cicadas did fall from the sky, but— you know, historically, it's been a great investment. But, you know, sometimes I speak to people, and one of the things I say to them is, do you really expect the stock market not only to crash, but to never recover?
Right.
Like it's going to go down and never come up again. And, you know, usually I don't get an answer because, you know, in their heart of hearts, they probably know that, no, it is going to come back up. But they're nervous about it.
Well, I get something. It's called, daily, it's an index. It's the Wilshire 6000 index. And I think it's pretty much the entire U.S. stock market. And it is absolutely fascinating, and people should look at it because one day it'll say the market was down X points, however they do it. This represents a paper loss of $20 trillion.
You know,
and paper being the operative word. And then the next day, it will be, say, this represents a paper gain of $15 trillion. And when you look at this and you think, there's a pattern here. It's up and it's down, but the famous Arthur Stein rule is the man with the yo-yo.
So the example I give is that historically the stock market's been like a man or woman walking up the hill with a yo-yo, and the yo-yo is going up and down and up and down and up and down. Well, at a certain point, that person will be so far up the hill that even when the yo-yo is at its lowest point, it'll still be higher than it was some time ago.
Yes.
And the market is like that. You know, even if we get a 50% decline, the market's still going to be above where it was some number of years ago. And if you're invested as a long-term investor, then you're still ahead. And of course, if you're an employee, you still have the opportunity to then invest every 2 weeks your new money in those lower priced stock funds, which people don't take advantage of frequently.
Eric wants us to take a break here, so we'll do that on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM, and then be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Arthur Stein. He's a well-known financial planner in the Washington area. Many of his clients are active duty federal workers or retirees. And he, at the first part of the show, was talking about an interesting client he had who was, he just said, 85 and going strong.
Prospect,
and
$2.5 million
in his account.
PSP.
Well done, sir. Well done. Before the break, we were talking about In effect, the psychological impact that the world news and politics has on people. And I mentioned that I look at this Wilshire Index every day, and it's literally, you know, one day things are great, one day things are gloomy. And if you followed it, if that was your guide, you'd be in the crazy house, you know.
Yeah.
But many people are doing things like that. But when you look at this, and you mentioned, there were people and clients who, when Trump was elected, they said, we're finished. And the exact same thing happened with Biden. People say, Biden's a Democrat's a president. And the Wilshire fund that I was talking about, the Wilshire tracking device, one of the things they had on their list was the day Trump was elected and the day he was inaugurated as president. And then they had the same thing. They now have the same thing for Biden and the election and inauguration, and even after the riot on Capitol Hill January 6th. And it's up and it's down. But it's mostly been, as you said, the trajectory is up.
Yeah. All the studies that I've seen show, you know, maybe a weak correlation between who's in the White House and the stock market. But it's, you know, Mike, it depends. If you know, the more sophisticated studies and start looking at, well, it's not only who's president, but who is in control of the Senate and who's in the control of the House, and does it do better? Does the market do better when the president's party controls both the House and the Senate or not? There's just not a strong correlation. And I know when President Trump was elected, I really did have a lot of people, not a lot, but about, I'd say 20% of my clients called me and said, should we pull out of the market? And I basically felt like, well, one, no, we don't, you know, there's not. But also, you know, especially with President Trump and the Republicans, you knew they were going to be good for business.
Yeah.
And indeed, they passed a tax law that greatly reduced corporate taxes, was very good for business. Well, that's good for the stock market. Now, President Biden, you know, you can't make that argument, but I feel like, you know, he's not going to, I don't think he's going to do anything that's terrible for business. So it's hard to time it that way. It's hard. It's a mistake, I think, to time it for current events. You know, we can name all kinds of current events that cause the market to temporarily decline, like 9/11 and Brexit and various other things. But, you know, the market tends to recover. I mean, the economy tends to go on. And, you know, listen, we've just come through a horrible, horrible 12-month period with COVID. I mean, it was the greatest blow to the economy maybe that there's ever been, and really serious. But, you know, the market did extremely well last year, the stock funds and the TSP, and it continues to do well this year. We're clearly coming out of COVID. Certain segments are not in good shape. A lot of individuals, you know, suffered enormous financial loss, but a lot of other individuals did not. And now businesses are coming back, and a lot of the government efforts really paid off in terms of the Paycheck Protection Program. I mean, I spoke to a business owner. He said, well, that's just why I'm still in business. If I didn't have that, I would not be in business. And because of it, I am. And now business is back. So if we're able to weather that, that's a lot.
Yeah, I know several people who would not be working now. They'd be unemployed and their companies would be down the tube except for this. Yeah, and many people think we learned some very good lessons from the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 about government intervention and the Fed and movement, and that it was, in a sense, it was better to throw money at this than not.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Well, 2008, yeah, they threw what was then considered a lot of money, you know, not now. And it was controversial, and it worked great.
Yeah.
You well, know, that's all you can say. Government efforts saved the economy.
Yeah. Well, and just a few weeks ago, you know, we had the Russian, alleged Russian hacking of that pipeline, and that caused a gas shortage all up and down the East Coast, very serious. And then you had the price of wood was going up. And then when you start thinking about it, when gasoline prices go up, virtually everything goes up. And people were predicting tremendous inflation. And I think they were, we've been in the 2% range for a long time, and now they're talking about it going much higher. And suddenly that seems to have abated.
Yeah, I don't think it's completely abated because, you know, there is just enormous amounts of deficit spending. But one, inflation is unnaturally, unusually low.
Yeah.
And it's been in the 2% range for so long. So if it, you know, it used to be the historic average was around 4%. And so inflation could go up quite a bit and still not be considered high by, you know, the historical evidence. And if it's a gradual increase in inflation, that's not necessarily damaging to the economy at all. And it certainly might be, and it does tend to have much less of a negative influence on stock prices and bond prices. I mean, stocks can benefit from inflation because they can raise prices, but, you know, bonds are different.
Here's one of the questions, kind of down in the weeds, but you're here to handle it. And he says, currently the P&E ratio is twice the historical average. Do fundamentals matter anymore in the stock market? And P&E?
Okay, the P-E ratio is the price-earnings ratio. And it's probably the most commonly used way to look at value in the stock market. And basically, with an individual company, you know, if they had $100 million in earnings, well, like, I'm not going to try. For each dollar of earnings, how much do you have to pay to buy stock that represents a dollar's worth of earnings? The higher the P-E ratio, you know, the higher, the more the stock market is overpriced, based again on historical averages. Mm-hmm. The problem is, like a lot of things, there are so many different ways to measure P-E ratios. I mean, so many. And the fact that maybe the market is overpriced right now doesn't mean that it's not going to become more overpriced in the future, or that, you know, again, maybe it'll just be we won't see great price increases for a while, but earnings will continue to increase, and then the P-E ratio will go down. So it's not really, I think, advisable to base your investments on the P-E ratio.
Okay. And anything like that, I mean, when people look at – you think of the tulip bubble in the 1500s. Yeah. It's the Bitcoin thing. Now, I noticed something in the – Post, the New York Times, it said the value of bitcoins had dropped below 30,000, which means absolutely nothing to me.
Yeah, I know it. So we're talking here about cryptocurrency. I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of it. You know, it's basically currency that exists in the digital world. It's created by individuals or maybe companies. And Bitcoin is the most famous one, but actually now there are about 5,000 different cryptocurrencies.
Wow.
And one that has done very well this year was actually literally created as a joke in about a 4 or 5 hour period by somebody who admits, I created this as a joke. And then all of a sudden it took off. And if you happen to own it, either as a joke or for whatever reason, you could have made an enormous amount of money.
Well, I read something too that the hackers that broke into that oil company, they were paid millions of dollars, but that the government got back about half of it, in part because it wasn't cryptocurrency.
No, it was. It was all Bitcoin.
But I mean, they managed to get half back because it somehow made it easier to get in.
See, this there's so much that. You know, of course, I don't understand about Bitcoin, but it's considered, you know, completely safe.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, here the government went in and just took this money out of this hacker's Bitcoin account.
Yeah.
So how safe can it be?
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be anonymous. Well, clearly this person was not anonymous. And
they got him. Yeah.
So anyway, I don't. Recommend Bitcoin investing.
Yeah, good for you. Here's one. Actually, the first email we got this morning, and the guys are reacting. And in case people have not read the Federal Report this morning, I urge you to do so. Not out of my ego, but Arthur wrote most of it. It's a way to plug the show, but he's talking about his philosophy and that sort of thing. And although this is John M., and he says, although I agree with much that Mr. Stein says, the mistakes he lists in the column were the result of bad moves, not bad advice. I know too many people that pay an anchor for an advisor for bad advice. It is true that not wanting to pay for services is one bad idea, but picking the wrong advisor is also a big mistake. Well, yeah.
Yeah, and I agree with that, John. I mean, what I said in the column was that, you know, I meet people who just right out admit that they made serious mistakes and it cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars in lost investment return. And, you know, then we talk about me managing their investments. I charge a percentage fee and they think, well, boy, that fee is really expensive. And I think, well, the fact that you lost $200,000 or $300,000 is much more expensive.
Yeah.
So. But I did emphasize in the article that if someone is hiring an investment advisor, an investment manager, hire someone who only works on what's called a fiduciary basis, which means that they can only work, they can only make recommendations that benefit you. They cannot make recommendations because they make more money on selling you some stock or an annuity or because they get a trip or a dinner if they sell a certain amount of an investment, which stockbrokers are allowed to do. Stockbrokers are not fiduciaries usually, and they are allowed to, you know, sell investments that are not in their client's best interest, either because they're more expensive than an alternative that's just as good or because it's not really a suitable investment for them. And I see that all the time. So, but even hiring a fiduciary is not a guarantee that they're going to help you, that they're going to make the right recommendations. And, you know, another question that I get is, can you outperform the market? And I'm not really trying to outperform the market because my clients, you know, want safety to a certain amount of safety, security, low volatility, however you want to call it. And but what I feel comfortable usually saying to them is I can outperform you and your decisions. And that's what we're speaking about. Would you be better off continuing to handle this yourself or would you be better off hiring somebody to manage the money for you? And if you've lost, and in the example I gave in the column today, person emailed me, he said, I lost $400,000 in potential returns because of the decisions that I made, and he outlined the decisions.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to hire an investment manager. Well, that's, you know, penny-wise, pound foolish.
Okay. We'll take a short break here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey, and I'm talking with Arthur Stein. He's a financial planner in the Washington area, and many of his clients are federal employees, so he knows the Thrift Savings Plan inside out, and glad to have him. Art, how do people get in touch with you?
Okay, well, my email address is art, A-R-T, at arthursteinfinancial.com, so that's arthursteinfinancial.com. And if you get on the website, you can sign up for my emails. I send out emails, for instance, when I blog about something people might be interested in. I just posted a blog yesterday about when you're retired and taking money out of your investments, which accounts to access first, like if you have an IRA and a TSP and a taxable account, how to make that decision and which types of funds. And I'd be happy to hear from any of your listeners.
Great. Well, you know, as we get older, we more increasingly read the obituary section. And I've noticed almost every week, sometimes several times a week, you'll see someone who died at a ripe old age, and they literally were retired longer than they worked. And this is not some kind of freak event anymore. It happens all the time. You mentioned your 85-year-old client who's still working, going strong.
And I spoke to someone yesterday whose uncle is 83 and just won a pickleball tournament.
Well, I have a friend who worked for the federal government, and he didn't like it, and he knew his stuff. He was a very sharp guy, and he figured out the exact day he could retire, the first day, and he literally retired, you know, within hours of that time. But he had a good salary, a good high salary, and his wife had a good high salary. They were both federal workers, so they're
and
okay.
And they were CSRS.
They were CSRS, exactly.
Big difference.
Exactly. So they had a much larger annuity. But a lot of people, vast majority of people working for the government, I mean, there are only a handful of CSRS left out there, a few thousand at most. So people are retiring under the FERS system, which, as everybody knows, is much less generous. Great 401k, but, you know, Social Security, but the civil service annuity is not as generous. And the thing that you frequently point out is the Diet Cola aspect, the fact that when people under the civil service retirement system get a cost of living adjustment, it is a full cost of living adjustment as measured by the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index, W. And so they keep pace with inflation. Retirees under FERS, if it's more than 2%, they get one percentage point less. So over time, and you've actually written some columns about this, but what it does to your spendable income.
Yeah, for CSRS employees, they frequently really didn't need investments because their annuity was so high, could be 80% of their high three, and they had a full cost of living adjustment. FERS are in a completely different situation. I mean, the system is designed in a way such that Social Security and the annuity are not expected to make up all your lost income from retirement. You're expected to be able to draw on your TSP balance. And one design feature that causes that result is that if inflation's more than 2%, the cost of living adjustment does not fully compensate retirees for inflation. So it means the purchasing power of their annuity is going down, and that compounds over time. And it, you know, you could easily see that the purchasing power of your annuity goes down 20-30% in retirement, depending upon how long you live. Second thing is that people need to plan for a really long retirement. Like, I'd say 95 is a good number, because medical care has gotten so good, and because the averages that we see on, you know, how long does the average American live, what's the life expectancy, really is for the population as a whole. If you look at the average life expectancy for people who are financially secure and have good health insurance and good medical care, it is much, much higher. And that's basically, you're talking federal retirees. You know, they may not consider themselves rich, but they have, you know, enough guaranteed income that if, you know, they should be able to make it work. And they have great health insurance. And They should be able to get good medical care. There have been studies that looked at, you know, just individual cities, looked at the poorest neighborhoods and the richest neighborhoods and the average life expectancy. And when they did that for D.C., the difference in the average life expectancy was 20 years. 20 years. So we have to assume, again, that, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, medical care is going to be even better at keeping us alive. So, you know, 95, that's a long time to be retired. It's a long time to be managing your investments and taking money out of your TSP and making sure that lasts throughout your entire retirement.
I used to have a series of, they were almost like comic books, it's a little bit smaller, but maybe 20, 25 pages. And it would say the wonderful year 1940 or the wonderful year 1975. And in each page, it said the average house in America costs $22,500. The average automobile, new automobile is. And it just shows you how prices change. And you know, many people, they remember back when things were cheap, but they forget what they were making at the time. You know?
Yeah, and many people just are not as are not protecting themselves against inflation in multiple ways. And one is, if you're investing in the G fund or even the F fund, you are not protecting yourself against inflation. I mean, you should expect the purchasing power of those investments, after we subtract out taxes, to decline over time. And people who want to pay off their mortgage, that's not a protection against inflation. I mean, you know, a mortgage is a great way to protect yourself against inflation because your payment is fixed and your annuity is going up every year with inflation. Yeah. So you have more and more money left over from paying your mortgage in various other ways. And it does affect people. Actually, according to the Labor Department, the inflation rate for seniors is higher than it is for the population as a whole because they're much more dependent upon people helping them out in various ways. And, you know, the price of people, you know, it's not like manufactured items that go down in price.
Right. And even if you have the best health insurance around, you still have more and higher medical bills on average as you get older.
Yeah, well, look at the health insurance premiums, how much they go up over time. I mean, they go up much more quickly than the inflation rate. And again, many people don't have long-term care insurance, and that's pretty much 100% labor costs. And so you know that the price of long-term care is going to increase faster than the inflation rate. Inflation's a big issue. And, you know, over a 20, 30-year retirement, it becomes a very big issue.
And especially if you're one of these who think that they're in the safe harbor of the G fund, so their money is protected, but that's...
It's only safe in the terms of not having any volatility. And, I mean, those bonds are guaranteed by the U.S. government, but the F fund, a very large percentage of those bonds are also government bonds. And... You know, historically, again, the F fund almost always outperforms the G fund. But TSP participants have very little money in the F fund. And the most popular fund is the G fund. And really, there's about eight times as much invested in the G fund as the F fund, even though the F fund almost always outperforms.
Yeah, it's interesting too, and it probably happens when you do a blog. But when you write anything, the cautionary thing about the G fund, some people react. They're very angry. They say they think this is sacred somehow, and you're
not sacred. Listen, it has its place. I mean, it's nice. It has a very good interest rate compared to, say, a bank account, which is also guaranteed by the government and also has no volatility. But the difference is, you know, last year the G fund was up 1%, and you could have been in a bank account that was up about 0.6 or 0.65. I actually was. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you look around on the internet, that's just not a huge difference, especially in a year when the stock funds were up double digits and the F fund last year was up 7.5%. So, you know, we're talking big difference.
That's a great rate of return, too, isn't it?
For a bond fund, it's a great rate of return.
Well, What are people asking? What are your clients now? You know, we've changed the presidency. We're maybe see the light at the end of the tunnel with a worldwide pandemic. Are people, are they anxious to do something?
You mean investment-wise?
Yes.
No. Mm-hmm. I'd say my clients, and if we're talking about retirees, most retirees just want to continue their lifestyle. You know, they don't expect to live better.
Yeah.
And they're also reluctant to spend the principal. You know, they don't mind spending income, but if the value of their investments is going down, they get worried. They tend to be very conservative people. And, you know, there was worry when we were in the pandemic and certainly March last year.
Yeah.
But now, you know, things look better. People are traveling. They're getting outdoors. They're going to restaurants. They just sort of feel a lot better about the world. And they just want to make sure that, you know, they're not over-allocated to stocks or under-allocated to stocks. And, of course, the appropriate allocation is different for different people.
Okay, we can take a short break here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Arthur Stein, financial planner in the Washington area, and we had really a good discussion. And Arthur, most of his clients, or many if not most, are federal workers or retirees, so he knows the market literally and knows the thrift savings plan. We're talking about the G Fund, right? And so many right. people, that's the favorite, I guess it's the largest number of people are in the G Fund. Yes. Those are Treasury securities.
The figures I have from last year were 30% of the money is in the G Fund.
Yeah.
And then the C Fund was about, it was close, but less.
Yeah, okay. And, of course, that goes with the values and all that, too. But,
yeah.
But I mean, you were saying that, you know, we love the G Fund, and it's well-intentioned, but not your preferred retirement income vehicle.
Because it doesn't keep up with inflation. And you know, if you look at historic returns for the G Fund, they've declined an enormous amount over time. You know, the fund was introduced in 1987, and the first full year was 88. And in 88 and 89, the G Fund returned 8.8% each year, and it was actually slightly more the following year. Well, then it just, you know, gradually declined over time. And, you know, last year, G Fund return was 1%. So, and that's at a time when, you know, prices are going up. You know, the inflation rate, the amount of inflation since 1988 is huge.
Yeah.
So, you know, with returns are 89% lower than 1988, you know, that's a tough way to fund your retirement.
Yeah, I remember when federal workers got a 9% raise and the unions booed the president for so
being
little.
So stingy.
So little, yeah. Yeah.
So it just... You know, it doesn't have any volatility, but people are way over invested in that. And, you know, they're told that the G Fund is completely safe, and it's not. It's just there's no volatility,
yeah.
But it's maximum risk from loss of purchasing power.
Yeah, which is huge. From time to time, Congress, the pressure groups, you know, there's a lot of money in the TSP, and a lot of people would like to get some of that action. And every now and then, Congress, a different member of Congress, will propose a green fund, a socially good
right.
fund, REIT, real estate investment trust fund, and those have been successfully fought off for the most part. And in most cases, given hindsight. The people that fought them were correct because those funds did not do that well, and people wouldn't have made the big bucks they thought. Now I've got the opposite. You've got some members of Congress looking at making sure the TSP doesn't do any investing in China.
Yeah, this has been interesting to say the least. You know, several years ago, the TSP announced that they were going to use a different index for the I Fund, the mm-hmm. International Stock Fund. And the index they're using now is not a very good index, actually. And it's one of the reasons the iFund just hasn't done that well. But they were going to go to a fund that invested in a much wider range of sectors and countries, including China, because, you know, China is a huge part of the world economy and its stock market is quite large. And members of the Senate and the House, not all of them, of course, but there was a very strong objection to that. And even though these plans had been agreed on and were being put in place, it, I don't know if it was the last minute, but, you know, it, shortly before the, it was supposed to happen, TSP had to back off and say, we're not going to make the change. And now there's a move, again, by some members of Congress to make it, I guess I would say, illegal for the TSP to invest in Chinese stocks in any way. And not Taiwanese, but, you know, mainland Chinese. So, you know, that's a political issue. It's a geopolitical issue. Clearly, we have an enormous, very sharp competition with China on a lot of in a lot of areas, and it's very aggressive in ways that we don't like as a country. It's I don't think of it actually as a huge loss for TSP investors. I mean, it's the Chinese stock market is just strange in a lot of ways. And what we've seen in the last 12 months is the Chinese government really getting involved in managing the success of companies in China because they have these huge internet and companies that do other things digitally that have become very powerful. And the Chinese government doesn't want them to be too powerful, and they've moved to, you know, reduce their power, reduce their influence, and I would guess that would reduce their profits. Well, that's a, you know, that's something. We don't have anything like that in the United States and most other countries. And so, you know, it's an issue. I think it's too bad it's become a political issue. And I hope there are not other investments that become a political issue. But this one, you know, as a TSP investor, I would not worry about.
And I love the line you said, we have to get out of here. But I love the line you said when somebody says, can you beat the stock market? And you say, no, but I can beat you.
Yes.
That's, okay.
That's
which is
what they need.
Which, as you're saying, is the purpose of having a financial
investment
advisor,
manager.
A fiduciary. Very good. Well, thank you so much, Arthur Stein. Thank you, Eric White, for producing. We'll see you all here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Stay safe.
You've been listening to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at WAEPA.org.
Welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Rick Wade, Senior Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Outreach at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Previously, Rick was a Senior Advisor and Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke. He worked closely with the Obama administration, and he also worked with Commerce's Economic Development Administration to foster regional economic development in distressed areas and with the Minority Business Development Agency to create jobs through the growth of minority-owned businesses. He received a BS from the University of South Carolina and an MPA from Harvard University. Rick, welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
And thank you so much for having me. Look forward to the conversation.
Rick, in today's environment, leaders have had to adapt and find new ways to lead with transparency and empathy. But can you tell us a bit about how you've adapted your leadership style?
You know, this past year has clearly presented some unique challenges that certainly me, or I as a leader, have had to adapt You think about a pandemic, for example, that has placed us in probably one of the most challenging circumstances is to sort of lead in a virtual world now. I've not been in my office for nearly a year. And the idea that we don't have the human interaction, which I think is very important when you think about the empathy that is a very important value of leadership. So trying to lead from a virtual environment, Shane, and be empathetic and be sensitive to the needs of others has presented a terribly difficult challenge. One of the other defining moments, I think, in our time that has dictated a change in leadership, if you will, was the murder of George Floyd. I think it created a whole different consciousness in America and certainly within me about the importance of being empathetic in the way I lead, to be inclusive, to lead in a way in which you're very sensitive to the impact of your decisions on others across our community. So it certainly has been a challenging year to adapt, but I'm happy to say that I'm still here and we're moving forward.
Perfect. Throughout your career, what have been some pivotal moments or lessons learned that have shaped the leader that you are today?
You know, there have been so many moments, Shane. I grew up in rural South Carolina. Quite honestly, at a time when I saw what legal segregation was. I mean, I wasn't able to go to an integrated school until middle school, being bused across town. And I remember, as strangely as it may sound, in 1979, I wanted to run for vice president of my student body at Lancaster High School, a rural school. And I had to run on the ballot as vice president Black, literally. And there was another candidate who ran as vice president White. And the irony of that story is that the following year, I ran for president and I won overwhelmingly. That was a lesson for me in leadership. And the lesson there was, you know, perseverance, have the tenacity, have a vision, and overcoming barriers. And I didn't let the idea that the construct that I had to run as vice president deter me from reaching my bigger dream, which was to represent students. So I know that's that perhaps may be a small example of leadership, but it really did define how I view myself, the vision that I have, my willingness to fight for change. And that was the beginning. I think that set the foundation of how I lead. And there've been so many other moments. One of the most defining moments for me personally was the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. A very close friend of mine, Senator Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who lost his life. And it conjured up, again, these issues of how deep the divide in terms of race in America is. But it also inspired me to lead even more and to lead harder and to lead with diligence and vigilance to help close that divide. So there have been so many defining moments in my career. I will tell you, even after the murder of George Floyd and my role at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to galvanize the business community inspired by that tragedy. And now we have a whole broad, historic, sweeping, what we call Equality of Opportunity Initiative that I'm leading, that I was inspired to develop. And we're bringing together corporations from across America to address what we call equality of opportunity. So my point there, I think with all of these moments, they've all been pivotal moments at different parts of my life, my career, my journey. And I've seized those moments to make the best of them, of what I could.
That's fantastic. It's a great, great answer. Many stories. Thank you very much for sharing that. Who is the most impactful leader in your life and what quality did you admire about them?
You know, I can't say that I had just one, but I would tell you the one person whose historical leadership has inspired me the most, and that is the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And there's so many attributes there that are consistent with my values, but the one part of his leadership was vision. And I mean, the idea that you can have a dream, which we often define and think of his big I Have a Dream speech. But I think that's a really important attribute of leadership, Shane, that you can sort of see beyond the challenges of today and see a better future for people and for yourself. So the idea that leaders have vision despite the challenges, is seeing a forest despite the trees, is seeing an opportunity despite the barriers. And that attribute, I think, is one that I embody. I mean, I'm very optimistic despite the challenges, despite the circumstances. So the whole notion of vision was a very important attribute that I learned and that I've tried to emulate from the leadership of Dr. King.
Wow, fantastic. And as someone who's got an extensive background in federal service and out of federal service, what advice would you give to feds looking to develop leadership skills? And you can talk about mid-career, senior career, early career. What comes to mind there?
Yeah, listen, I mean, you're aware that I had the fortunate opportunity. We didn't have a Secretary of Commerce when President Obama, of course, I served as one of his senior advisors, was inaugurated. And the president asked me to go to the Department of Commerce to hold the fort down. And that was one of the most exciting experiences in my entire career, not just for the title and the wonderful experiences, but I understood the value of federal employees. And folks forget sometimes, Shane, that we political appointees, we come and go. But the folks who are grinding every day, who are at their desk no matter rain, sleet, or snow, who bring innovations but yet don't get the credit for it because the political appointees get all the credit. I think I learned something about the humility of being a leader. And I built so many friends who were federal employees, not just at the manager level, but the frontline workers, the administrative assistants. And I was very deliberate. I mean, one of the things that I was most proud of, strangely enough, I was that guy, even though I was senior advisor to the Secretary of Commerce, and my office was on the floor, the top floor. We call it the blue carpet, Shane. But I made a deliberate point to go eat in the cafeteria every day, as many days as I could, just to sit down and talk with employees. And I grew from that. And there were so many times where I took their ideas back to the blue carpet and said, and I told it, the Secretary Locke, you got to go down and sit down and talk with regular, common, everyday folks. They're in the cafeteria, not in the dining room on the blue carpet. And so he started doing that. So the point is, I think for me, the advice that I would give is to continue to do the hard work. I do think that we should do a better job in government in providing the kind of admiration for those workers as we do the high level appointees. And that may be something that I'm looking to work on myself to help continue to advocate for our federal employees. Those are the hard workers. That's where the work gets done. And so I think that's a lesson for me. If there was some advice and counsel I could give, is to continue to do your work. But we have to do our work as leaders of these agencies to create ladders of success and reward and admiration for the hard work that they do.
Rick, thank you very much. You've inspired me. These are tremendous insights and stories. I love every single one of them. You've got a fascinating journey in leadership yourself. And thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Thank you for listening to today's Lessons in Leadership podcast. And until we see you next time, take good care.